Welcome, everybody. My name is Mordechai Cohen, I think I'm being recorded here, so I'll be careful what I say. Try anyway. I want to welcome everybody to the Yom Iyun that has been organized by, I see a lot of students here, so I can say, by your colleagues, and in the spirit of Kimu v'Kiblu Ayudim Alehem Bal Zaram, the notion that Am Yisrael received the Torah at Har Sinai in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, and then the Gemara says that Hadar Kiblu Abimei Achashverosh, Am Yisrael received it again willingly in the time of Achashverosh. That shows you that the importance of constant renewal and constant joy in receiving the Torah and constant innovation. And that can only occur if students, like the students who organized this, or who initiated, I should say, Yehuda Bernstein and Simcha Gross, and also Mr. Stuart Halpern, who is a student of mine in Revel as well, they've taken the initiative to get together this program, which is really a fabulous program. It's not something that the administration cooked up. It's not top-down. It's really bottom-up, and I think that that's a wonderful indication of the interest in serious Limud Torah, and in this case, in Limud Tanakh. The subject that I've chosen, the title that I've chosen, is taken from Rashbam, as we'll see today. Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with it. Hapshatot Hamitchadshim Bechol Yom. Rashbam speaks about, and this is actually a difficult phrase to translate it into English, but I think most of us understand it, mitchadshim, to become ever new, to become new every day. Hapshatot hamitchadshim bechol yom, pshat becomes new every day. So you guys can try to figure out how to translate that, and it's always, as I said, a challenge. There's a professor in Israel today whom we'll mention, Elazar Twito, who wrote his book. He's made his career on Rashbam, and he wrote his book. The title is Hapshato Tamid Chadshim Bechol Yom, quite appropriately. The problem is, in Israel, if you publish a book, they always like it if you have an English title, and I don't think that the English really did justice to either to Rashbam or to Twito, so I won't even mention it here. But I think the concept, I think, is quite clear, that there's always innovation in Parshanut HaMikra, in the interpretation of Tanakh. And I'd like to speak about today something that you would think is kind of an oxymoron, the new trends in the study of Parshanut HaMikra, by which I do not mean the new interpretations that are given nowadays. And I'm sure other people in this program are doing that, and I think that that's something that is very, very important, to come up with new approaches, new interpretations of Tanakh per se. But my own interest and my own research is primarily on the history of Parshanut HaMikra, the tradition of Parshanut HaMikra, meaning looking at the Mefarshim that we have and that we have had for centuries within our tradition. And that, I think, is one of the important components of what I would call the traditional or the orthodox study of Tanakh. Again, not to say that within orthodoxy you can't have new interpretations in the 20th and 21st centuries, and you'll see that that was actually what happened in the 11th and 12th centuries, that there was constantly innovation within the tradition of Parshanut HaMikra. But why would we say that that's new? We've had Rashi for 900 years. We've had Rashbam for almost as long as well. But the reality is, in the last 30 years or so, okay, that's not so much. In 30 years, this tradition has become much clearer to us. We have a much better perception of who the Mefarshim were, who was Rashi, who was Ibn Ezra, who was Rashbam, what made them think, what were the influences on their thought, how did they interact. And this is something that recent scholarship has revealed in many ways. And that's what I'd like to bring to your attention today. Just a small sample of some of that scholarship, which is very new and very vibrant, and it's continuing to this day, and I think it will still continue for a long time. And the benefit here is that all of you sitting in this room, just looking around, I think all have an understanding, have an appreciation of Rashi already, of Ibn Ezra, of Rashban. These are household names, but I think that there's much more scholarship, or much more that scholarship has to offer, that we can appreciate these Parshanim in a greater light, in a better light, in a clearer light. And just to encapsulate that, or to characterize it, I like to quote a story by Rav Soloveitchik, that Rav Soloveitchik used to say, Zichrono Livracha, when teaching in Yeshiva University. Rav Soloveitchik's spirit certainly looms large as he influenced generations of students within these walls. Rav Soloveitchik describes how when he gave shir, that he felt as though while he was giving shir to 30 or 40 students, sometimes more than that, many times more than that, that the door would open up, and sometimes it was a student who came late, but sometimes he felt as though it was Rabbeinu Tam walking into the room and taking a seat next to one of the students, or the Rambam walking into the room. And while he was giving his shir, that some of the students were asking questions, and Rabbeinu Tam would say to the Rambam, you know what, Rambam, this young student has a good question on you. What do you say? How do you answer that? And then another student would pipe up to defend the Rambam, defend Rabbeinu Tam, but that the Rishonim themselves walked into the room and were part of the discussion because the Torah came alive. The chain of tradition came alive. All of the Mefarshim, they weren't just words on a page. It wasn't just dead letters. It was actual people who came back to life. And I remember when I first heard this, when I first read it, I said, you know, it's a very mystical concept, Tchiyas HaMesim, Gilgal Neshamos, you know, how do you explain it? And as I've been teaching for a number of years in Yeshiva College and in Stern College and in Bernard Revel, I see, as my students, I have really wonderful students, many of them in the room here, although I think you can learn more from the others because you've already heard what I have to say, but certainly I see that that's true, but a lot of that has to do with the new scholarship that gives us a much better picture of the medieval milieu in which these Parshanim lived and worked. And the first thing I think we sometimes have to get over is the format of the Mikraos Gedolos. You know, we all, many people get for a bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah, the Mikraos Gedolos, and that's sort of that the Tzurat Hadaf, is canonized or is ingrained in our mind. I guess nowadays there are new editions and new versions, but that's sort of an innovation. Until recently, there was really one format of the Mikraos Gedolos. And Rashi to us is, you know, in Rashi script. That's sort of, we imagine Rashi sort of in that mindset. Ibn Ezra, we know where he is on the page. Ramban, similarly, and actually, although I use usually the Torat Chaim edition because I think it's a little bit better than the old text, one of the criticisms is that you can't tell which Mefarish is which because it's all the same font, whereas in the older edition, it's different fonts. But the way people sort of imagine Rashi is through the prism of the Mikraos Gedolos. Rashi's words on a page, Ibn Ezra's words on a page, so much so that people imagine that when Rashi became Bar Mitzvah, that he got a Mikraos Gedolos, except there was no Rashi. He had to fill that in. That was Rashi's job, that was Ibn Ezra's job, but it didn't work that way. When Rashi was a young man, which Mefarshim did he have on the page? Probably none. If you wanted to learn Tanakh in Rashi's time, you went to the Gemara or you went to the Midrash. Whom did Ibn Ezra have on his page? Well, it wasn't Rashi when he was a young man. The Rambam never mentions Rashi. Never, in all of his writings, never mentions Rashi once. So it's a scholarly question. The Rambam lived quite a bit after Rashi. Whom did the Rambam have? How did these Mefarshim learn Tanakh? This is what is coming alive now. And so I'd like to just share a little bit of this very exciting world of Parshanut HaMikra with you. And I've given out two pages on the handouts that I'll refer to. I'll try not to read them all inside. You can look at them later on as well. One is a chart that I think is very helpful to sort of orient us, and sometimes it's helpful if you have a map with it, but I didn't do that for whatever reason. You can see the dates are very important, but there are fundamentally two traditions of Parshanut that we must talk about. And just to illustrate to you some of the new things that are going on that are very exciting, as I said. If you look at the Rambam at the bottom of the left-hand column, his dates are, well, actually, I should have revised this. This is an older chart that I did not revise this date. It's 1135 is the way people assume that the Rambam was born, and now scholars decided it's 1138. But you get give or take a few years. The Rambam is one of the few people we know exact dates for. So let's say it's 1138 to 1204. The Rambam was born in Muslim Spain, which was under Muslim domination. It was in the western edge of the Muslim Empire. He left Spain because of persecution when he was a young man. Went to North Africa and then to Egypt. As I said, the Rambam does not mention Rashi, nor does he mention Rashbam. He might mention Rabbeinu Tam. In one of his letters, he refers to a certain Rabbeinu Yaakov. Doesn't say Rabbeinu Yaakov Tam, it could be Rabbeinu Tam. But really, Rambam's connection with the northern French tradition was very limited. The Rambam mentions two great Parshanim. Who are the great Parshanim in Al-Andalus, in Muslim Spain? The Rambam mentions Rabbi Moshe ibn Jikatila, whom you have a few lines higher in the 11th century in Muslim Spain, and Rabbi Yehuda ibn Balaam, whom I don't even have here. But those were the great Mefarshim for the Rambam. And they were for Ibn Ezra as well. Who were these Mefarshim? They are not household names for us, but they were for the Rambam. They were lost because they wrote also in Arabic, as the Rambam did, by the way, for most of his writings, except for Mishneh Torah, except the Rambam's writings were translated. Ibn Balaam and Ibn Shikatila were not translated. However, recently, these texts have been found, and now people, scholars in Israel, are translating some of Ibn Shikatila is very fragmentary, but Ibn Balaam, many more of his writings are available. Some of them were found in the Cairo Geniza and are being republished or published for the first time and translated into Hebrew as well. Just to give you a sense of this tradition, Rav Sadia Gaon is a very important name. As a matter of fact, if you look here in the chart, he's at the top of the left-hand side. Rav Sadia Gaon was born in Egypt and then moved to Bavel, to Iraq, and lived in Baghdad, which was a very, very vibrant intellectual center of the time. He wrote extensive commentaries on Tanakh. And Ibn Ezra, Avram Ibn Ezra, refers to Rav Sadia Gaon as Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom, the first speaker on all matters, on philosophy, on grammar, on piyutim, on halakha, and that was really his stature. But if you wanted to learn Rav Sadia Gaon's commentaries, until the 1970s, he wrote a commentary on Tehillim, on Iov, on Mishle, on Daniel, on Chamesh Megillot, some of the Megillot. You had to go to manuscripts in Arabic. They were translated in the 70s by Rav Kafach, Zichrono Livracha, who translated many Judeo-Arabic works. And I still remember when I was in college in 1984 that Rav Sadia Gaon's commentary on Breshit came out. It was translated by Moshe Zucker and published in the Arabic with the Hebrew translation. Now, that to me is Hapshatot Tamid Chadshim B'chol Yom. Now, I know when I speak to some of my students, now especially, they're not so impressed by 1984. It isn't so recent. But when I was a kid growing up, there was a book called 1984, in the future. So it's not, I was telling my kids are even younger, I told them when I was a child, we watched Lost in Space. And that was set in 1999, something way far in the future. But okay, so the future becomes the past. So 1984 doesn't impress, younger people now. But I remember when I was giving a course in Stern College in 2000, which is not so long ago, Rashbam's commentary on Iov. Okay, if you open up even the Mikros Gedolos, you have Rashi and you have Ibn Ezra. Rashbam, who is Rashi's grandson, as many of you know, wrote a commentary on Iyov, which is a very valuable commentary. It was published for the first time in the year 2000 from a manuscript by a very important scholar in Israel nowadays, Sari Yefet. And that's an extremely valuable commentary that just came out in 2000. Okay, if that's not impressive enough, Sara Yefet is now working. She's devoted much of her scholarship to Rashbam. In 1985, she published Rashbam's commentary on Kohelet, and now she's working on Rashbam's commentary on Shir HaShirim, which, if you want to study currently, there is an edition of it with a translation that was published as a dissertation, but that's not as easy to use. It's not readily available. And this is something that Sari Yefet is working on currently. So within a year or two, I'll be teaching Shir HaShirim, which is in my cycle of courses that I teach. And I'll say, here is the newly published Rashbam's commentary on Shir HaShirim. But I think you get a sense of the importance of the texts that are now becoming available. But I'd also like to talk a little bit, again, that's just by way of introduction. That's a very important aspect. The publication of new texts is very important. But also in terms of the study of the Parshanim themselves, the words that we've read over the centuries that we know are seen in a new light. And I'd like to focus attention on Rashi's conception of Pshuto Shel Mikra, and many of you know, and this is in the texts that I've published or that I've printed out for you here, many of these are based on a comment by Rashi that's very famous, which I didn't even print out here, but Rashi has a very famous program of his Parshanut. What is his Parshanut going to be all about? Rashi says, Yesh Midrashei Agadah Rabim. Chazal have many midrashim on the various Sifrei Tanakh, and then Rashi says, "Va'ani lo bati ela lipshuto shel mikra." What I'm going to do is something new. I'm going to give you pshuto shel mikra, and much ink has been spilled on this because anyone who's read Rashi's commentary, and that includes everybody in this room, I'm sure, knows that much of Rashi is based on Midrash, is a reworking of Midrash, and it's very valuable for that purpose. But how does that match that program of Pshuto Shel Mikra? And so the reality is, if you look in Ibn Ezra, and this is the first source on the page here, Ibn Ezra writes in one of his grammatical works, Sefer Safa Brura, gives you his response to Rashi, his reaction. Now, before we actually read this, it's important to understand the cultural background, that we're getting much more of a sense now, again, because of studies that are being done about Ibn Ezra, but I can encapsulate it very briefly. Avraham Ibn Ezra is a very important, a very pivotal figure, I think. If you look, he's written in bold and big letters here in the left-hand side of the chart. He was born in Spain. It's not clear whether Christian Spain or Muslim Spain, but culturally it was very similar. He was immersed in the culture that is sometimes called the Babylonian-Iberian culture. Sometimes we call it the Sephardic culture, but Sfarad really properly is only Spain. It really started in Bavel. There was a very strong connection between the Gaonim in Bavel and the culture of the Jews in Muslim Spain. Much more, for example, it was easier to get mail from Bavel to Spain than it was from Spain to northern France because of the cultural division, because of the Christian lands and the Muslim. Ibn Ezra grew up in Muslim Spain, or was educated probably in Muslim Spain around the time of Rashi. He was born in 1089. That makes him 50 years younger than Rashi. However, Ibn Ezra probably did not read Rashi when he was a youth growing up. Ibn Ezra's commentaries, the commentaries that he uses, that he quotes extensively, are on the left side of this chart. Rav Sadia Gaon, as I mentioned, Rosh HaMedabrim B'chol Makom, very, very important. That doesn't mean he doesn't disagree with Rav Sadia, but he always quotes Rav Sadia Gaon. Another important figure is Yehuda Chayuj. Yehuda Chayuj was some regarded as the founder of Hebrew grammar because he discovered the idea of the shoresh in Hebrew having three letters. That's something most of us learned in second grade. Okay, but Rashi did not have Chayyuch's grammar. Rashi had earlier grammarians who came in the generation before Chayyuch, Dunash and Menachem, who wrote in Hebrew. So Rashi had their work, but Rashi did not have Chayyuch. So he had a different grammatical system. He had a system that still worked with Shorashim with two letters or one letter, which is hard for us to imagine. But Ibn Ezra had Chayyuch. He actually translated some of Chayyuch's works from Arabic into Hebrew. And then very importantly, he had Ibn Janach, who really is regarded as the father of Hebrew grammar. Ibn Janach codified Chayyuch's works, and then all subsequent Parshanim in Muslim Spain used Chayyuch's works, and that included Ibn Shikatila and Ibn Balam. The Rambam, for example, Rav Yosef Kimchi, David Kimchi, the Ramban, they all worked with that system. And Ibn Ezra is very important, among other things, because he wrote commentaries in Hebrew. And he was one of the first in this tradition to do so. And essentially, he crystallized what earlier Parshanim had done, but did it in Hebrew. Why did he write his commentaries in Hebrew? Had he stayed in Muslim Spain, he would have written them in Arabic like others in the tradition. However, at age 50, Ibn Ezra had a midlife crisis, which was a real crisis. It wasn't just that he decided he was bored with his first career. Ibn Ezra had to leave Muslim Spain because of persecution of the Jews around the same time as the Rambam. Now, Ibn Ezra, until age 50, was not a Parshan. We know Ibn Ezra as one of the famous Mefarshim. So again, his Mikros Gedolos, when he was a kid, was lacking Ibn Ezra, so he had to put that in. Avraham Ibn Ezra was not a Parshan when he was, until age 50. Yes, he wrote no Perushim. His profession was to write poetry. And interestingly, if you look two lines above Avraham Ibn Ezra, you see Moshe Ibn Ezra. Moshe Ibn Ezra was one of the great poets in Muslim Spain, no relationship to Avraham Ibn Ezra, but he did know of Avraham Ibn Ezra. Moshe Ibn Ezra's protege was Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, also a very important poet, a philosopher as well. But Moshe Ibn Ezra is very important, and I plan to mention this later in the lecture today. Moshe Ibn Ezra wrote, in addition to his poetry, he also wrote a book on Hebrew poetics, on how to write Hebrew poetry as the Jews did in Muslim Spain. This was considered the golden age of Hebrew poetry, Hebrew literature. The Jews in Muslim Spain wrote poetry according to the rules of Arabic poetics. Arabic poetics was very well defined, very well developed, and the Jews embraced that. Moshe Ibn Ezra wrote a book on how to write Hebrew poetry according to the rules of Arabic poetics. Now, lest you think that the Jews are just embracing something entirely foreign, Moshe Ibn Ezra says if we look in Tanakh itself, you can find precedents for the Arabic poetic techniques. So what we're doing is a kind of updated version of a takeoff on biblical literature. So he's very connected with that, and we'll discuss that in a few moments. But as part of his survey of Hebrew literature, and it's very, very fascinating because it's a kind of snapshot of who were the big names, who were the important Parshanim in his time, and you're looking at him, he's a contemporary of Rashi, 1055 to 1138, 15 years younger, but he's essentially very similar in his time. He never mentions Rashi, of course, again, because he's living in Muslim Spain. Who were the great Talmudists of his time, before the Rambam? Okay, who is the great Talmudist? Two generations before the Rambam in Spain. Again, he's not talking about Rashi. The Rif. The Rif was very important. Rav Yitzchak ibn Giat was also very important. I think he may mention the Ri Migash. I can't remember now. If he does, I know that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote a eulogy for the Ri Migash, and I don't remember now if Moshe Ibn Ezra mentions him or not. We have to check in his work. But interestingly, he mentions two up-and-coming young poets in Muslim Spain. One of them is Yehuda HaLevi, and the other is Avraham ibn Ezra. Now, so that's a testimony, a contemporary testimony of the greatness of Avraham ibn Ezra. He did not know of Avraham ibn Ezra as a Parshan, because he lived only until 1138, and he wrote this in the 1130s. Ibn Ezra was in his 40s at that time, but Ibn Ezra in 1140, when he was age 50, he had to leave Spain. He moved to Italy. And in Italy, which was a Christian land, obviously, in Rome, can't get more Christian than that, he became aware of Rashi's commentaries. Rashi's commentaries spread like wildfire in Christian lands. It took a longer time to get to Muslim lands. So Ibn Ezra first encountered Rashi at age 50. And you see in source number one his reaction to Rashi. Ibn Ezra, I imagine, had a culture shock, because he comes to Christian lands. The Jews there could not read Arabic. They didn't have Rav Sadia Gaon, they didn't have Chayuj, they didn't have Ibn Janaf, they didn't have all the great Mefarshim. So he asks people there, how do you study Tanakh without Rav Sadia Gaon, without Ibn Janaf? And they said, with Rashi. So he looked at Rashi, he read Rashi, and Rashi says, Ani lo bati ala lepshuto shel mikra. And so he says here, Rashi thinks that he's doing pshat. Rashi, he says, Rav Shlomo Zal, second line in this source, Rav Shlomo Zal piresh hatanach al derech drash. Call a spade a spade. Rashi is drash. Most of Rashi is drash. V'hu choshev kihu al derech pshat. Rashi thinks that it's pshat because he didn't have all of the great parshanim in the Sephardic tradition. V'ein b'sifro pshat rak echad mini aleph. There's not more of the pshat in Rashi, more than one in a thousand. All right, so that might be a little bit too much. And Rashi for us is sanctified by tradition of hundreds of years. Don't forget, this was written soon after Rashi's death. So Rashi did not loom as large for Ibn Ezra as he does for us. But what Ibn Ezra set about to do for the next 25 years or so, he died, I think, in 1164, and this is an approximation. He traveled from town to town in Italy, in southern France, in northern France, and he died probably in England in the 1160s. For the next 25 years, from age 50 to age 75, he wrote all of the commentaries that we have, and we have extensive commentaries by Ibn Ezra, and that's how he popularized the Shitot, the approaches of Rav Sadia Gaon, of Ibn Shikatila, of Ibn Balaam, and the other Parshanim that, by the way, the Rambam had when he studied Tanakh. But Ibn Ezra is only one approach to Rashi. What I've given you here in source number two is Rashbam's take on what Rashi did. And here I've quoted a very famous comment, but again, I would like to share some thoughts, new thoughts on what this all means. Rashbam here takes a long view of the study of Torah, Parshanut HaMikra, in northern France. And he quotes the Ma'amar Chazal, Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto, which was Rashi's motto. Rashi said, Ani lo bati ela lipshuto shel mikra. So why did Rashi give you so much midrash? Why didn't he do more pshat? So I'm not going to read it inside, not the whole thing anyway, but what he says is that Rashi set his heart to the pshat. Natan lev lefaresh pshuto shel mikra. But Rashi could not do it all himself. And Rashbam says, you have to understand, when Rashi started out, there was no pshat in northern France. They didn't have all of the grammatical, linguistic work of Chayuj and Ibn Janach and Ibn Shikatila and their commentaries. Rashi only had midrashim, and Rashbam says that that's all that they studied. They'd study Tanakh only with midrash, only with Gemara. And Rashi's chidush was to do pshat. That was an amazing chidush. And even if he did it only sporadically, it still was an enormous chiddush. And Rashbam says, I'm going to complete what Rashi started. Rashi started, and let's say, all right, if you had to pick a percentage, how much of Rashi is pshat? Let's say Ibn Ezra is 2 machmir, 1 in 1,000, right? That's less than 1%. But let's say 10% of Rashi is pshat, 15%, how much can you push it, 20%? Let's say 10%. Rashi, what Rashbam is saying, a little bit differently than Ibn Ezra, although they're not disagreeing over the facts, it's just how do you look at it. Rashbam says Rashi went from 0 to 10. Rashbam goes from 10 to 100%. Rashbam is 100% Pshuto Shel Mikra in his commentaries, and we'll discuss in a few moments. What's the greater chidush? 0 to 10. That you're doing something Yesh Me'ayin, something completely novel within that tradition. And here is one thing you can take home from this lecture. If you don't take anything else home, and if you're my student, you've heard this before. I think it's very important when we look at the Mikros Gedolos, people typically now, the first Mefarish that we look at is Rashi. And then people look at Ibn Ezra. So Rashi is so traditional, he quotes all these Midrashim, and then you look at Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra has questions on the Midrashim. He said, did it really happen this way? And he's very radical, very rationalist. People look at Ibn Ezra as a tremendous, radical iconoclast. Rashi is very traditional, and it's exactly the opposite. Ibn Ezra was following a very clear, delineated tradition from Rav Sadia Gaon. From Rav Sadia Gaon to the next generation, to Chayuj, to Ibn Janach, to Ibn Shekatila, Ibn Ezra was purely within the Gaonic Andalusian tradition. Rashi was completely innovative. Rashi was a Mechadish. And that's what Rashbam says here. Rashbam says that Rashi wrote commentaries according to a new methodology, a revolutionary methodology, because before that, it was only Midrash. And what Rashbam says here is that that spirit of innovation continued into the next generation, into Rashi's students, and Rashbam was one of those students. Rashbam says at the end of the paragraph here, he says, Af ani Shmuel ben Rabbi Meir, nitvakachti imo ulefanav. I argued with him, I debated with him, the hodali, she'ilu hayalo pnai, Rashi admitted to me, he acknowledged, if he would have an opportunity, hayat sarich lasot perushim acherim, lefi hapshatot hamitchadshim b'chol yom. He would have had to write new commentaries according to the renewing, ever new pshat interpretations. Tweeto's translation here is the exegesis in perpetual motion, which is a very, very strange translation, but he's trying to say he can't translate it literally. That become new every day, so that emerge anew every day. So you figure out how to translate that, but you get the idea. There's a spirit of innovation here. Now, this is a passage that has gotten a lot of attention from a very important scholar in Israel nowadays by the name of Elazar Tweeto, who actually taught here in Yeshiva University in the 1980s. I was privileged to be in his class for the 2 semesters that he was here. And that was a time when he was publishing his really seminal and revolutionary works about the Northern French tradition of Parshanut. And he published just recently, in 2003, his book, which is a collection of his articles, and that's entitled Hapshatot HaMitchadshim B'chol Yom. And in that book, he describes how this spirit of innovation came about. And there are 2 things to note about the concept of chidush. One of them is, first of all, and this is Tweeto's real chidush, I think. Elazar Tweeto is actually Algerian, so his origin is, we would call, Sfardi, and yet he has a great interest in Rashi, devoted his life to his scholarship to Rashi and Rashbam. So you have to understand, in Algeria, the Jews, the education that they got was in French. So French was his mother tongue, and some Arabic, but he said more French than Arabic, and then he moved to Israel as part of the Aliyah. But he spent a good deal of time in France studying Latin and studying the way that the Latin learning developed in the 12th century. And what he began to see and then published in his articles was the fascinating parallels between the renaissance of Latin learning in the 12th century, and scholars of Latin learning have discussed this as well, and this started in the 20s, but it's continuing the Northern French Renaissance of the 12th century, where there was a new emphasis on the study of history and science and grammar and literature as there never was before, that was separate from the church, which was very different. Until the 12th century, the mode of learning was what was called monastic learning, and that was part of the learning of scholarship, of classical scholarship, but more the church fathers and the Bible, according to the rule of Saint Benedict in the monasteries. And the way that monastic learning was taken down was that the teacher would teach, the students would write the notes, or monks would copy over the church fathers, and there was an emphasis on tradition. In the 12th century, you began to see the emergence of a new kind of learning, of scholastic learning, of a dialectic, where there were debates. A teacher would come into the class and would pose a question, and the students and the teachers would debate. And Tweeto, I remember, still told us, he said, "Nitvakachti imo ulefanav," where Ashban uses that phrase, that you don't see in the Gemara. "Nitvakachti imo ulefanav." I debated with my teacher. That is a symptom of the scholastic method of learning. There's a desire to learn the text in a new light, in a new way. And what began to happen in the 12th century in northern France, and a century later you would see the start of the universities, was this dialectic. And the ability to learn the ancient texts in a way that was different, to learn it historically, to learn it grammatically, aside from the tradition of the church. And Tweeto said part, or mentioned to us, not his chiddush, I mean it is his chiddush, but it's in the scholarship of the Latin study, the Christian study of the Bible, there was all of a sudden an interest in the literal sense of the Bible, which was very foreign. Usually, the way that Christians studied the Bible was allegorically. All of a sudden, there was interest in the literal sense of the text, which was always what they accused the Jews of doing, that the Jews follow the text literally. But they started saying, you know what? Let's look at the Hebrew text. Let's start to look at the Hebrew text. They started asking Jews about it. And what Tweeto said, it can't be an accident that this happened at the same time in the Beit Midrash of Rashi and in the surrounding commentaries of the Christians. So it would seem that there was a spirit of something new in the air. And in his book and in his articles, Tweeto shows a number of parallels. Rashbam begins to think of the text historically, scientifically, and grammatically. And remember, Rashi and Rashbam did not have access to Rav Sadia Gaon, to Ibn Jekatila or Ibn Janach. This is what they were doing in the spirit of this new kind of learning. And that's Hapshatot Hamit Chadshim Bechol Yom. This new spirit, that was what was motivating Rashi, doing something completely innovative, something entirely new. But it's not just in the learning of Tanakh, and this is something that Tweeto wrote in his book in 2003. This is a chiddush in comparison with his articles in the 80s. There's much new work being done now on the Balei HaTosfot, which is Talmudic study. The Balei HaTosfot, especially Rabbeinu Tam, who was Rashbam's younger brother, but Rashbam as well, speak about new methods of learning Talmud. Chidushei Rabbeinu Tam. There are chidushim. There's a new method. And the emphasis on chidush is something that is characteristic of the Balei HaTosfot. Ibn Ezra never once says, I have a chidush. Never calls his perush a chidush. You don't have chidushim. Ibn Ezra does not characterize himself as a chidush. But he does have innovations. But he doesn't see himself as being revolutionary because he wasn't. His greatness was that he crystallized and codified that tradition. I'm a great devotee of Ibn Ezra, but he doesn't characterize himself as being novel, as being innovative. That's what Rashi's tradition was. That's what Rashbam did. That's what Rabbeinu Tam did within his environment. Rabbeinu Tam in Talmud and Rashbam in Parshanut HaMikra. Now, there were other, by the way, other Parshanim as well, Rav Yosef Kara, not to be confused with Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, but Rav Yosef Kara was a Talmid Chaver of Rashi. I've indicated that here on the right-hand side of the chart as well. And perhaps in another occasion I would elaborate on his important works, but you'll see some other important scholars, Parshanim, within this tradition as well. Rabbeinu Tam, by the way, did write a commentary on Iov that was also, I think, that was recently found and recently published. Let me give some examples of what this new methodology entailed. And in source number 3, I'll quote a pasuk, Rashi on a pasuk that we all know very well, in Az Yashir, Yimin Hashem Nedari Bakoach, Yimin Hashem Tirats Oyev. And there is a difficulty in this pasuk that you've all probably thought about, you probably have seen Rashi, where there's a repetition in the pasuk. Why does it have to say Yimincha twice? So Rashi says, Yimincha, Yimincha shtei pe'amim, Kishi Yisrael osim ritzono shel makom hasmol naseit yamin. Yamincha Hashem nedari bakoach is God's right hand, but the second yamincha is really the small. So it's like yamincha Hashem, your right hand is nedari bakoach, is glorious in strength, and your left hand destroys the enemies. So it's not a repetition. So why does it call the left hand the right hand? Because when Am Yisrael do Ritzon Hashem, their left hand, which is the Midas Hadin, becomes Midas Harachamim. So Rashi explains it. Yimin Hashem Nedari Bakoach, the right hand Midas Harachamim, is Lehatzilet Yisrael, to save Israel at the time of Kriyat Yamsuf. V'yimin Hashenit Tirat Soyev. So the left hand is destroying the enemy. And so that's Midas Hadin for the enemy, but it's Midas Harachamim for Am Yisrael. Rashi, of course, got this from the Midrash, and as Rashi typically will do, is he will quote a Midrash if there's a difficulty in the pasuk. Now, before I go on in Rashi, and you'll see why I'm interrupting, Professor Tweeto's second very important innovation, and most scholars would be happy to have one, make one big mark on history, and I think that the idea of the connection between Rashbam and Rashi's Beit Midrash and what was going on in their society is of very, very important, very great importance in terms of understanding who they were. And Tweeto has documented this extensively in his book. Some of, for example, he shows how sometimes Rashbam will say what he's writing here is l'tshuvat haminim, to answer the Christian criticisms of the Jews. He said they misunderstood the Tanakh at this point. And so you can see that he had discussions with Christians as well. So he puts Rashbam within his environment very clearly. So that is of phenomenal importance in terms of understanding, in terms of appreciating the tradition of Parshanut. The other very important innovation that he had, again, that he, I remember this was probably just being published at the time that he came out. I think his study came out in 1987. Came and gave a summer course in 86. One of the things that Tweeto did is he studied the manuscripts of Rashi's commentaries. And many of those are still in France, but there are really libraries all over the world. And he went and he did a scientific study of those manuscripts. And he found something amazing. The amount of disparity that there is in the various manuscripts of Rashi is very different from any other text that we have. The Rambam, Ibn Ezra, the Balei HaTosfot, the diversity is very striking. And that it often happens that you have one, we're very used to the idea of the Dibur HaMatchil, of the Davar Acher in Rashi. Or of, you have Midrasho, and then you have Pshuto, and then various Mefarshim try to explain, Mefarshi Rashi, why did Rashi have to give you Pshuto and Midrasho? Sometimes you have three commentaries, sometimes you have four commentaries within a single Rashi. Tweeto showed that in many manuscripts where you have a double commentary in the Mikros Gedolos, all you have is one comment in many of the older manuscripts. And then they have another generation of manuscripts where you have the second commentary on the margin. And then in the next generation of manuscripts, it's brought into the text itself with the word Tosefet. And then it becomes just part of the text itself. And so Twito wrote a groundbreaking study in 1987, that's when it was published, that the title was Al Gilgulei Hanusach Shel Perush Rashi La Torah, the Gilgulim, I forgot how now he translated that into English, but you know what Gilgul is, the various lives of Rashi's commentary. And what he pointed out is that those notes on the sides that came into the text of Rashi were by Rashi's students. And we have some manuscripts where the comments on the sides you actually see, this is by Rav Yosef Kara or this is by Rashbam. Now, subsequent to that, there's another scholar in Israel by the name of Avram Grossman, who in the 1990s published a number of articles based on a manuscript that he found that he thinks indicates that Rashi himself told his scribe or his secretary, Rabbi Shmaya, to put those comments into the text. So Grossman says it's not added later on, it's not added by students, it was added by Rashi himself. So I would say the following. There's very little nafkamina between Twito's argument, between Twito and Grossman about this. Because let's say, and here's an example, Rashi originally wrote only one perush on this pasuk. He used the midrash. Then we have in Rashi, it says, Upshuto shel mikra, a different perush. Yemincha nederet bakoch ma melachta, yemincha hi tirat soyev. V'kama mikraot dugmato. Rashi says that this is part of the style, the poetic style of Tanakh. And here you have a whole list. Ki inei oivecha, Hashem ki inei oivecha yovedu. Ad matay reshem Hashem, ad matay reshem yalozu. Nasu ne'arot Hashem, nasu ne'arot kolan. So you have pshuto shel mikra next to midrasho, and pshuto is based on the stylistic tendencies within Tanakh itself. And that's what's labeled pshuto shel mikra. If you look in Rashbam's commentary here, you see the exact same commentary, or a very similar commentary to this. What Twito said is that this was not originally Rashi's commentary, this was Rashbam's commentary. So Grossman said, well, Rashbam told it to Rashi, and Rashi said to put it in. You know what? That's probably true. Because if you look in number four, here we have a comment that scholars refer to as Tosfot ala Torah, which really just means comments on the side, on the margins of Rashi. And here in this text, it says that this idea was the idea of Rabbeinu Shmuel. You see the bold Kol Zem Yesod Rabbeinu Shmuel, who is Rashbam. Ukeshahaya Rabbeinu Shlomo. Who's Rabbeinu Shlomo? That's Rashi Zikeno, his grandfather Rabbeinu Shlomo. Magia lotam psukim, hayakore otam psuke Shmuel al Shmo. Rashbam had this chiddush and Rashi liked it. Rashi said, these are psuke Shmuel. So what does that tell you? Even if Rashi said to put it into his commentary, it was Rashbam's idea. And that's what Rashbam said, nitvakachti imo ulefanav. He agreed to me. What does that tell you? Rashi did not write a commentary that was a sealed work. Rashi was a mechadesh, and he encouraged others to have chidushim beyond what he had done himself. And that's one of the ideas you get of the pshatot tamid chadshim b'chol yom. I'm running out of time at this point, but I did want to bring at least one or two other thoughts to your attention. And I mentioned Moshe Ibn Ezra, who had written a work on poetics, and here in source number 5, I'm quoting from his work on poetics, he lists 20 Arabic poetic techniques. And among those Arabic poetic techniques are what we would call anaphora. He wrote this in Arabic. In Arabic, it's called tardid. And I won't read you the whole passage here, but essentially what Moshe Ibn Ezra does is he says that this is one of the stylistic tendencies of Tanakh. The Psukei Shmuel that Rashbam figured out all by himself, Moshe Ibn Ezra already had in his book on poetics. Now, what does that tell you? And here I'll just share with you an interesting anecdote. I gave a lecture at a conference where Sara Yefet was present, and she's a scholar of Rashbam, very devoted to Rashbam. And I spoke about Moshe Ibn Ezra's poetic sense of biblical poetics. And she raised her hand, sorry, Effet, at the end of the lecture, raised her hand and said, Mordechai, what about Rashbam's literary sense? How come you didn't mention that? Okay, and this was just after her book on Eov had been published, and there she has a significant section on the Rashbam's literary sense on Eov. And so I said to her, and I said to the audience, we all know that Sari Effet published her book, and there she shows Rashbam's great literary sense. It's true. And I said, I'll say something that you'll like and something you won't like so much. What I said is Rashbam was probably smarter than Moshe Ibn Ezra. So she liked that, because she's very partisan to Rashbam. Why was he smarter? Well, Moshe Ibn Ezra was a trained poet, and he studied poetics based on Arabic works on poetry. So he took Poetics 101, which defines all of these techniques, and then he looks at Tanakh, and he applies it to Tanakh. And that is wonderful. You get a real sense of his literary perception of Tanakh, and recent scholarship has shown a lot about Moshe Ibn Ezra's work on Parshanut HaMikra. He normally was not viewed as a Parshan. That's something that in my own work I've tried to make the argument, and I've published on that as well. But he was not brilliant. He was just applying something that was already developed. Similarly, Hayuj, for example, discovered the three-letter Shoresh in Hebrew because the Arabs saw this in Arabic as well in their sister languages. Rashbam discovered this without poetics. He discovered it all by himself, all alone. That shows tremendous brilliance. He was a tremendous Mechadosh. But at the same time, while Rashbam is smarter, imagine going to a doctor who didn't go to medical school, but he was so brilliant that he figured out all by himself, discovered a new medicine. Okay, someone nowadays, without going to medical school, would discover aspirin. Okay, that guy's really brilliant, but he knows only one medicine. The person who's less brilliant, who went to medical school and learned from the other doctors, probably will be a better doctor because he sees the big picture. Moshe Ibn Ezra sees the big picture of poetics because he has what to work with. He has a foundation that he borrowed from others. And this, subsequent to that exchange, I described very briefly the difference between Moshe Ibn Ezra's poetics and Rashbam's. I was asked to submit an article in honor of Sari Effet. The book just came out now, and the title is Rashbam versus Moshe Ibn Ezra, Two Perspectives on Biblical Poetics. So now, there is a lot more to do here, but really I'm finishing off at this point. The last three sources have to do with Shir HaShirim. I will leave that for another opportunity, the reality is you get a bit of a sense here of two traditions at work. What were the influences? What were the various Parshanim thinking? This is all part of the Pshato Tamid Chadshim B'chol Yom, and it hasn't stopped today, and I think it'll continue for years to come. And I thank you for sharing with me this exposure to the various Parshanim.